Hello and welcome back to the MJA Pod. My name is Kate Swanell and I am your host. Back in July, new international guidelines for the diagnosis and management of polycystic ovary syndrome were released. The guidelines are Australian-led and brought together clinicians, academics and women with PCOS in a unique collaboration. What makes these guidelines particularly special is the inclusion of translational resources for both clinicians on the coalface and patients, including a new app called Ask PCOS. Professor Helena Teed and Associate Professor Jacqueline Boyle, both from the Centre for Research Excellence in PCOS at Monash University, were lead investigators for the guidelines, and they are my guests today on the pod. Congratulations on these guidelines. A two-year process, I gather.
Actually, probably longer than that, Kate, because what we did was we engaged with health professionals and women from around the world, 3,500 of them, to establish where the key problems were, where the key gaps were, and Jackie's done a lot of engagement with Indigenous populations she can talk to you about. We really scoped where the gaps were, what we needed to do very thoroughly before we started. Then we did the international and national engagement. Then the actual guideline process itself took about 18 months, and now the translation will go for another 18 months.
Why did it take so long to put together a set of international guidelines? Was it every country for itself up until then?
No, the time is not necessarily unreasonable. The first time you develop a set of guidelines, it takes a substantial amount of effort. Subsequently, updating those guidelines is a relatively simple process. But as you can imagine, getting engagement and funding from bodies including the NHMRC, but international societies as well, from the European Society and the American Society in Reproductive Medicine, that takes stakeholder engagement. And then getting 37 societies around the world to sign up and to say, yes, this will be the international guideline, we won't replicate the work, we'll engage. And that process takes considerable time and went alongside the 50-plus systematic reviews that were completed as part of the work. Now on, we only need to update those systematic reviews, but we had to break the tape here. Next time we just need to ask it.
That's a good analogy.
I don't think it was over. If you think about it, if each major condition that was prioritised, and this is 13% of women, if each major condition had a single unified international guideline, the amount of wasted effort would make the investment worthwhile.
What is the incidence of PCOS now in Australia?
Worldwide, it's between 8 and 13% based on the Rotterdam criteria. It is higher in some groups of women. And so, for example, in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, we have reported that it's around 18% using the Rotterdam criteria, but that it does increase with obesity, given that obesity is a rising problem globally. Unfortunately, that's going to also impact on PCOS.
Why is it higher in the Indigenous population, Jackie? What's driving that?
I think it's still unclear. We do know that PCOS can be related to birth weight. But it's also, as I say, related to, and there's probably other intrauterine factors. We also know that it's related to obesity and central obesity, and that's certainly a factor with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, so generally with that. Yeah, some of that, women experience some socioeconomic disadvantage and where then are less able to engage, or it's less easy for them to engage in healthy lifestyles, so they're more likely to end up with increased weight at an early age.
What are the guideline recommendations that have changed since the Australian guidelines in 2011 were written up?
So the main things that have changed in this guideline is we have for the first time grounded the Rotterdam diagnostic criteria in evidence. Previously it was a census statement, Kate, so it was really about what the experts thought. This process is very far from that. This is the experts, the GPs, the women, and all the evidence that's now available coming together. And we have actually changed the Rotterdam criteria.
What are those criteria now?
So the first thing we did was define what each one of the criteria were. So it is irregular menstrual cycles reflecting oligoanovulation, clinical hyperandrogenism, with hirsutism, and in adult women acne. And the third one is biochemical hyperandrogenism, and then polycystic ovarian morphology on ultrasound. They were not very well defined before. There were different definitions of what irregular cycles were different in adolescence. It was really confusing.
So we went right into the literature to pull out what is an abnormal menstrual cycle, and we've done it based on gynecological age of years post-menarche, and it's now very, very clear what is abnormal menstrual cycle and what's not. We've defined exactly what defines clinical hyperandrogenism, and that's much simpler and much clearer. Same with biochemical, and have significantly increased the number of follicles per ovary to be defined as polycystic ovary syndrome. Yeah, and the main reason for the change in the number of follicles from 12 up to 20 is that the revolution of our ultrasound is so much better now.
Yes.
That everybody can have follicles here and large follicles on their ultrasound. So it's really important that we define that number, and that's now just the first thing was to define each one of those criteria. The second thing was then to look at their accuracy in diagnosing the condition. And the primary change we have made there is that in adolescents, ultrasound is not recommended for the diagnosis of PCOS anymore.
Why is that?
Because it's normal in your pubertal transition to have a very high follicle count.
Right.
Ovary.
Yep.
Normal part of the transition. So, and what we've done is we said within 8 years of menarche, so if a girl goes through menarche at 16, it's not until she's 24. If she goes through it at the average age of 12, it's not until she's 20. After that 8 years, it's just quite reliable to look at the follicle count per ovary, and if they have more than 20 on either ovary or a 10 mil volume on either ovary, then they've got the criteria. But when they're under those years post-menarche, so less than 8 years, we've not recommended it because it's simply not accurate and may be risk of overdiagnosis. That means in practice is that the original National Institute of Health or NIH diagnostic criteria, which were in place up to 2003, hold for adolescents, for adult women, the Rotterdam criteria where it's two of irregular cycles, hyperandrogenism, and or their ovaries on ultrasound. That holds for adult women, but not for adolescents.
Because overdiagnosis can be a problem, can't it?
Interesting point, actually, Kate. There's a concern amongst the paediatricians. One of the interesting things about getting women, GPs, paediatricians, reproductive endocrinologists and endocrinologists in the room is that paediatricians were very reluctant to what they call overdiagnosis. The women had a very strong voice that they knew they had something that was a problem and they wanted to know what it was. They didn't want other people to make the decision about whether or not they got told about the diagnosis. And the other thing is the reproductive group said, please tell these women when they've got the condition. Please don't just put them on the pill. Take away their opportunities for early family planning, family initiation, and for preventative healthy lifestyle and for management of their symptoms. You don't just know them, they can't fix it. So when we put them all in the room and we looked at the evidence, there is major evidence, Becky's been involved in this as well. Around the world, women wait too long to get diagnosed or are missed, and that's the overwhelming body of evidence. There is no evidence at all that women are being overdiagnosed. It's a concern amongst clinicians, and it's primarily related to that oversensitivity of the ultrasound in young women. So we will now be able to address that because we've very clearly articulated don't use that in young women to make the diagnosis. So overdiagnosis is a potential concern, but there's no evidence to occur.
I think one of the other things, Helena, was in the fertility recommendations, where there was a difference. We're now recommending letrozole as one of the first-line treatments for an ovulatory infertility if there's no other issues contributing to the infertility.
Yes, true, Jackie. So that's the first time, Kate, that has been clearly recommended. Letrozole is now first-line. And the other thing that's new is there hasn't been any IVF recommendations in PCOS.
Yep.
Time that's happened, and here they're recommended as third line after oral ovulation induction agents, then gonadotropins or surgery, and only then IVF.
If I'm a GP, how should these guidelines change my practice when a woman walks in and I suspect PCOS?
So the really good thing, and again, Jessie's been very involved in this, is that the GP can now download a free, very simple GP tool, which is a couple of pages of colour flip charts designed by GPs for GPs.
Great.
It's something you just glance at. It has all the key features outlined, and it makes it very easy. There's also a GP care plan template, again designed by GPs, which runs through all the key features very quickly that need to be of concern for women with PCOS. And that can also allow them to access care plans for referral if they need it. But that really summarises everything that's key in the guideline. And perhaps I can hand over to Jackie to talk about the fact that for women, the diagnosis and education and information is really important, and that's what the guideline resources do.
I'm chatting today with Helena Teed and Jackie Boyle from the Centre for Research Excellence in PCOS. Their co-authored guideline summary is published by the MJA and can be found at mja.com.au. And of course, the link to the full guidelines is in that article.
So I also think that for GPs, that it's really clear now in the guidelines about what tests you need to do and that you don't need to do a large number of tests. So I think it really does give a very clear guide on what you need to be thinking of, and that actually if someone has clinical hyperandrogenism and irregular cycles, that, you know, you can diagnose PCOS with excluding other causes without doing a whole battery of other investigations. So I think it actually makes it quite easy and quite clear on what it is and how you don't need to do everything anymore looking at that Rotterdam diagnostic criteria. And in terms of for women, we've done an extensive education and translation program as well. So we have infographics and fact sheets that are really easy to read on our website, and also linked to the app that we've developed. They really give a lot of information that's evidence-based and linked to the recommendations of the guidelines. And on the app itself, women can enter in their own information, and then what they're most interested in will then be prioritised on what comes up on their app. And there's also a set of, we did a question prompt list that we've focus tested and with women who have PCOS. And so we've then adapted that and put that on the app as well. So there's a list of very common questions that women want to know the answers to. And whilst they can go and ask those to their healthcare provider, we've actually provided most of the answers to those on the actual app. So hopefully then they only really need to go to their health provider with the really key pertinent ones that they couldn't find answers to.
Tell us more about the app. What's it called and where can they get it?
So it's called Ask PCOS, and it's currently on iTunes, and it will be available on Android from mid-October. There is a very small fee, but it's non-commercial, so really the fee that's being charged at the moment is just to contribute towards maintenance of the app. We don't want to make a profit out of this.
No.
We're really just looking to provide information, reliable and evidence-based information to women in a really easy-to-read format that's accessible for everyone.
It sounds like what's going to happen now is that women will get diagnosed earlier. They'll get diagnosed with less invasive and less onerous tests, and their management will be much more streamlined and pathway driven. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I think it is. And Kate, the other thing is that women will be much more empowered to understand their condition. It's pretty hard to expect every GP to know a lot about this. It's fairly complex, but the treatments are not, you know, a routine. All GPs are familiar with the oral contraceptive pill. The guideline also talks for the first time really clearly about the role of metformin. Our health providers are very comfortable with the treatments that are available. They may just not be aware of all the details and nuances around the summary. So we've provided that for women. And yes, tests are simpler, as Jesse said. The treatments are pretty simple and straightforward. So the health provider component of that partnership with women is now much easier. But the biggest gap that women have, which is getting more information about all the features of the condition, getting evidence-based, reliable, credible information.
Yep.
So Jackie did a lot of research around showing what's out there is largely commercially driven, about promoting individual diets that are not evidence-based or products that don't help. So this is the first time there's been an evidence-based app that is completely non-commercial. It's the first time that the information for women across all features, including infertility treatments, has been there to empower them to make an effective choice about their treatment.
The emotional well-being, I think that certainly has been a real focus from the consumers, from women, that the impact of their emotional well-being and their quality of life, and that is under-recognised as well by healthcare providers. And that's certainly been demonstrated in research that's been done with endocrinologists and gynaecologists. And I think, you know, for a lot of health providers, that seems a bit too hard to do and outside their scope of practice. So I think what the guidelines do is have a view. They recommend often to first to be aware, and then secondly, to there's some very simple screening questions that you can ask women, and if they screen positive, then you know that you probably should be referring on if that's outside your scope of practice. So I think that that's really important, because it's hard, you know, if women have infertility, then that's obviously going to contribute to their emotional well-being, and particularly if they already have underlying problems with their emotional well-being due to their PCOS, and also their ability to engage in a healthy active lifestyle and diet. If you're feeling depressed or anxious, then that's really going to impair your ability to be motivated and to be able to go and do this sort of thing. So it's really important that we look at their health, at women's health care holistically.
Yesterday, Jackie and I presented to the Fertility Society of Australia, and that's one of 65 national and international conference symposiums that are being presenting the guidelines. And every time we do this, and including yesterday, there was an international world leader in reproductive health who stood up and said, this has actually never been done before, bringing this many countries and this many disparate disciplines with consumers and primary care providers to the table to actually say, what is the most important? How can we help? How do we make this information evidence-based but clinically appropriate? And then how do we translate it in a reachable way? And he basically said, look, congratulations, Australia should be very proud of this. And indeed, there are some of us now who are on international guideline task forces who are struggling with a lot of this, and we're now helping to inform them around how internationally we might move to a system where there is one big, reputable international guideline that's not driven necessarily by the hero experts, but actually for the evidence, the experts, the primary health professionals who practice at the coalface, and the people with a condition together, and then have, you know, because they're doing it once, consolidated and collectively, they then have the ability to then translate and reach and make a difference for the guideline, not just write the guideline.
I think the point you made about the overdiagnosis perception being different between doctors and patients is the key, isn't it? I mean, if you can get both perspectives involved in all guidelines, then you've got to be a step closer to better care, surely.
Yes, and that's now the world's best practice, but it's not, you know, it is something that you need expertise in, or to have that expertise within the team, and lifestyle post management. But I think we would say that I think Australia should be proud of this effort, and really it was primarily a very good example of partnership between consumers and patients, healthcare providers, experts and government. It was a really, really good partnership to have a significant impact. And we're now working with government on a number of other opportunities of key priority gap areas. We don't need for everything, Kate. This is a substantive investment, but there are areas where, you know, yet another randomised controlled trial, which is more expensive than this effort, won't necessarily change practice at all. But a guideline will, we can give you one other example. There are 105 randomised controlled trials of lifestyle intervention in pregnancy, and it works. We don't need to do any more randomised controlled trials in pregnancy. What we need to do is bring together the guidelines, and again, Jackie's been leading a body of work where we brought together all the existing guidelines around the world and actually integrated them in a formal process to actually, called the ADAPT process, to bring them together into one consolidated body of evidence. Jackie's now hosting a forum that has talked about bringing all the world experts and consumers and healthcare providers to the table about how to take a similar path in conception and pregnancy health. Jackie, did you want to touch on that?
We're doing a similar process where we're doing, so we've looked at all the guidelines internationally and in a systematic review, and then we've bringing together a group of international experts and consumers and we're all meeting in October, and then we've been doing some priority setting around preconception and pregnancy, healthy lifestyle and preconception and pregnancy health.
Yes.
And then we hope to come out of that with a, you know, big vision picture that will then inform how we work together as with a consensus and a international perspective on having some evidence-based international guidelines similarly in that area. I think the other thing is that everyone is bringing a huge body of formative work from their own countries who are attending the meeting, so with both consumers and with healthcare providers, and it's really, and most of the people coming have also been looking at mostly the translation and implementation in those areas. So it would be fantastic to get. So we've really made a big effort to make sure that we have people from a spectrum of countries as well. So we have representatives from lower middle income countries, as well as Europe, USA, Canada, Australia, Asia, and a representative from WHO. So we really hope that this will be able to have a very collaborative and significant impact.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks so much.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.